Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. When Russia invaded Ukraine, it didn't just take territory. It separated thousands of Ukrainian children from the only home that they had ever known, relocating them to Russia-occupied territory or to Russia itself. Many of those children have not been returned. Tonight, Frontline PBS shows us what happened to many of those children. We're joined by Paul Kenyon. He is the director and producer of the new Frontline documentary, Children of Ukraine. It airs tonight on PBS KLRN at 9 o'clock Central. And Paul, welcome to The Source.
Hi, it's good to be with you. I'm in the UK, as you know, so it's late in the afternoon, early evening here, and I'm near Oxford in the UK, near the place with the very grand ancient university.
Well, tonight on your program, I had an opportunity to get an early view of it, and I can tell you there are many moments in there that are heartbreaking, that we see the toll, we see it in the faces of these children, the trauma that they experienced, and how their families are struggling to reconnect with them. Many ups and downs in this documentary, Paul.
Yeah, there are. I've been going to Ukraine as a journalist and film director since 2014. And as you know, the war that we've all come to take notice of began in February 2022. And there were rumors that many children were being taken from around the war front and taken by Russian officials and Russian soldiers, being taken back into Russia, away from their parents, and that they were being dressed in Russian uniforms and that they were being forced to sing the Russian anthem. In other words, they were being indoctrinated, as Ukraine would say. And we decided to look into that, to spend some time researching it and filming it. And it's an extraordinary story. And some of your listeners may know that, that already Putin and his children's commissioner, there are arrest warrants already from the International Criminal Court, so the ICC, alleging that they have criminal responsibility, and this is where our program comes in, for the unlawful deportation and transfer of children from occupied areas of Ukraine into Russia. So there's already arrest warrants for the two, but of course it's a very different thing to practically bring them to anywhere where they would be put on trial. But that's how we started out. We knew these arrest warrants had been made, and we started to try and find some of the cases and put together what was happening.
Is this action by Ukraine, by Russia to obtain these children, kidnap these children or lure them into Russia, is this organized? Was this part of Russian policy?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And the answer to that is yes. It is organized. It's systemic. It's happened, in fact, all the way back to 2014, which you may remember is when Crimea was annexed by the Russians. So it's been happening for quite a considerable period of time. But in 2022, it picked up. It's got an awful lot more serious and a lot more people are involved. So organized, yes. They couldn't do it without the permission of the Russian state. So that is the only way that this could have happened. So
This is not like some Russian soldier who said, "I like this kid. I'm going to take him back to me to Moscow, and we're going to give him a house or whatever." This is an actual, say, the Kremlin said, "Go do this," and they did this.
Yeah, this comes from the top. So this is alleged to have come from their children's commissioner, who's a friend of Putin, who's called Maria Lvova-Belova. And she has five adopted children of her own, one of them a Ukrainian child from Mariupol. Because you remember them, that the first big city to get taken over early in this conflict was Mariupol. The city was surrounded. And what actually happens, and I'll tell you, because there's some practical sort of intrigue here about how it happens. As the Russian front sweeps forward, as it did in February 2022, there are children's homes and orphanages, and there are schools which they take over. And the Russians will say, when we're doing that, there are children on the fighting front, and we need to protect those children from the war. And the way that we do that is to spirit them back into Russian territory, take them away from the fighting. But the Ukrainians would say, Why are you taking them in that direction? Why don't you allow them to flee with their families back into Ukraine proper? So that's what's happening. And you can hear from what I'm saying, that's the Russian response is, we're protecting them, we're rescuing these children. And then the children end up in Russian territory. And whilst they're there, they are, the Ukrainians would say, and our program will say, they are subjected to extraordinary levels of propaganda. And this is part of what is alleged by the International Criminal Court is a war crime. Because if you're taking away by force the unlawful deportation of these children, and then you're undermining their statehood, their ethnicity, i.e. being Ukrainian, then that is seen as a war crime. And that is what the Ukrainians want to put, one of the many things, but something that they want to put Putin in the dock for.
So what is the objective of Russia? Is this just for propaganda points? Are they trying to erode Ukraine's long-term stability and identity? I've heard that Russia is so hurting with their demographics, they need young people. Was that the goal?
Yeah, I think that there's an element of that. I mean, wars work on many different levels, and we're all just used to seeing terrible violence and the destruction of buildings and the deaths of many on television and hearing about it on the radio. But actually, this is another level, which the Ukrainians would say is about destroying their background, their culture, their idea of Ukrainianism, if you like. So their beliefs in their own sort of origin and ethnicity. Why the Russians are doing it, as I say, that's what Ukraine would say about them trying to destroy their nationhood through a different route, really, through a psychological route. But, you know, some of these children, we have evidence that when they're taken by Russia, they're put into camps in Crimea quite often, and then some of them are transferred to military training camps. And the idea there is to get them into the army. And once you're in the Russian army, we know what the conflict at the moment that they will be called into is to fight against Ukraine. So you would end up with Ukrainian children or young men by that stage fighting their own country. And imagine that if that was one of our children, the idea there, then fighting against the country of their parents and their neighbors and their grandparents and of their own identity. It's an extraordinary thing. We, you know, at the moment, just to give your listeners an idea of the scale of this, Ukraine says there are 19,000 children still missing that they cannot find. They can't get back into Ukrainian territory. So this isn't one or two. This is systemic. And it has serious consequences. So that huge area along through eastern Ukraine, what is known as Donbass, you know, that is changing the perspective of a whole new generation of people is what the Russians seem to be doing. And that's what the Ukrainians would allege.
How difficult would it be for a child who grew up in Ukraine to be assimilated into Russia? I mean, Ukrainian and Russian, the languages, I guess they're similar, but they're not identical. I mean, would it be difficult?
Yeah, it's a really good question, actually, about language, because back in 2014, when I started going to that area of eastern Ukraine, a lot of people, I would say the majority, did speak Russian along that border. So they were right up against the Russian border. They spoke Russian. The history of this, and people might think, come on, what's language got to do with it? But it's fascinating. So that over the recent decades, the language of Ukrainian, has been suppressed, and it has been weeded out quite a lot in the sense that whilst they were part of the Soviet Union, everybody was taught to speak Russian, and they were made to think that Ukrainian was the language of sort of peasant farmers and of the past and something that they didn't need to aspire to, something that was ridiculed in Russia. And that has changed now. They realize that by so many of them speaking Russian, it looks as though they are sympathetic to the Russian perspective and interested in being ruled from Moscow. And of course, the majority of Ukrainians are not. So what's interesting is that since I first started going there, the Ukrainians now speak Ukrainian. All of them that I meet now speak Ukrainian. And the reason that happened, interestingly, despite the fact that a lot used to speak Russian, now they see Russian as the language of the oppressor. And it was their children, teenagers, who were coming home from school during the last 2 years and saying to their parents, why are you speaking Russian? That's not our language. They are the ones. It's come from the young people upwards, if you like, who try to encourage their parents to speak Ukrainian. So your question, quite rightly, was, you know, how could these children, do they even speak the same language? Well, they will do. They will speak Russian, and they'll be encouraged when they're taken by the Russians to continue speaking Russian. But if they stayed in Ukraine, the pressure there and the general drive there is to get everybody to speak Ukrainian. So it's a real point of conflict, the very language of these two nationalities.
Right, and your point there also is how Putin's plan to invade Ukraine, which he claimed was part of Russia, that it backfired and actually created a stronger Ukrainian identity. And I wonder how much of that identity these children actually share and they're able to cling to after they go to these re-education camps.
Yeah, that's, again, it's a good point. I mean, I'll tell you, and you may know this because you've seen the film, we spoke to a number of children who have been taken by the Russians and then have managed to get back to Ukraine. Some of them managed to escape, and some of them were brought back by various NGOs who did it informally and managed to get the orphanages and schools in Russia to return them. So these children have returned, and they would say that they didn't give in, that they were subjected to propaganda every day, like I was saying, the Russian anthem, and wearing the Russian uniform. I mean, they had to do it because they'd be punished if they didn't, but they didn't give in. And there's one slightly, I mean, there is, although it's a tragic story, there is one moment of sort of dark comedy where one of our interviewees, he was being held in a Russian camp, and they instructed him to go and raise the Russian flag one morning on the flagpole. And instead of raising the Russian flag, he attached a pair of his underpants and raised his underpants above the camp. All right. And obviously got in serious trouble for it. But that was his protest.
That's a great kid. I got to take a break. This is a one-minute break, and we're going to be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from La Fonda on Main, honoring the authentic cuisine of interior Mexico since 1932. Open for lunch, brunch, and dinner. More information at lafondaonmain.com.
The EarthX 2024 Environmental and Sustainability Congress of Conferences is happening in Dallas, April 22nd through the 26th, bringing together all sides with one important mission: protect our planet. For info, earthx.org.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Tonight at 9 o'clock on PBS KLRN in San Antonio, Frontline documentary airs Children of Ukraine. Having a conversation with the director and producer of that Frontline documentary, Paul Kenyon. He is a journalist and author who has reported on conflict zones around the world for the BBC and others. So, Paul, there's conflicting things going on with these children. I guess they're relatively safe where they are in Russia. And if they are repatriated back into Ukraine, they are going into a war zone where they could be killed.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, funnily enough, that's what the Russians will say. So the Russian official line is, we're saving them, we're protecting them. They need to be away from the war front. But of course, you know, there are plenty of areas in Ukraine, and I've traveled around it extensively, where you are relatively safe. You know, all along through western Ukraine, which is where a lot of people go and congregate if they don't want to be close to the fighting front. So, you know, even though we see these images on the news of destroyed buildings and the horror of it, that is indeed the case in the east of Ukraine. But in the west and in the main body of central Ukraine, there are places of safety. And of course, the point is, David, that in the end, these children should be with their families where they belong. And I'm sure you would agree with that. And the idea that they would be taken to strange families, you know, perhaps there'd be an argument for it if they were in immediate danger and they were being taken to institutions where they were allowed to speak Ukrainian, they were allowed to speak to their own parents, they were allowed to continue their studies as before. But they're not. A lot of them have their telephones removed. They're not allowed or unable to contact their families and their neighbors, and there's no route back. So the Russians keep saying, whenever we've spoken to them about it, they've said, well, you know, if the families want to go and collect their children from these Russian schools and orphanages and camps, they have, you know, let them go and do it. They have every right to. But of course, they don't really have the possibility of doing that because a Ukrainian would have to cross the border. We know some of them do. They go the long way around, all the way through Belarus. They travel thousands of miles. But in the end, a lot of them are picked up and returned home by the Russian security services. And it takes real chutzpah, real daring and courage, doesn't it? If you're a female and you're saying, I'm going to travel to Russia by myself to go and pick up my missing children, it's a difficult thing to do because a lot of these young women with small children, their husbands will, of course, be in the Ukrainian military. So they will be fighting on the opposite side. So in effect, what you're doing as a young woman is you're traveling to the enemy country who's attacking your own country and who your own husband is fighting against. So it's a big ask to say, will they get, they're welcome to come and pick up their children.
Well, and Paul, there's no small amount of slack-jawed irony when Russia says we need to rescue these children from the bombs, but it's Russia that is lobbing those bombs into the Ukraine.
Yeah, and that's it. And you've hit the nail on the head there. That from the outset, they've said, we're protecting them from incoming Ukrainian shelling. But of course, you're right. It's the Ukrainians are shelling back against the Russians' advance into their own territory. So a lot of these children that we spoke to, I mean, one in particular called Artem, he was in school when the Russians came and took that area. They swept through. So suddenly his school, when he turned that morning, when he set off, he was heading to a part of Ukraine near the front. By the time he arrived at school, it became part of Russia. The Russians swept through. So now he's in his school and he's behind Russian lines. So the Russians will say, but now look what's happening. The Ukrainians are bombing around your school. So we have to save you, taking you back into Russian territory. But you're absolutely right, David. The reason they were shelling in the first place, if they were in that case, is to try and hold back the Russian advance. So, yeah, I think your analysis is correct.
And we have seen, I don't know if this was the original intent, but Russia is going to take advantage of having these children in their grips for a propaganda point. So they've put them on display in Russian media. How does that play with Russians, do you think? Does it seem like they're trying to justify the war by saying we have saved these children?
Yeah, absolutely. It plays really well with the Russian audience. There's an extraordinary scene in our film where Putin himself is on stage in a huge stadium in the middle of Moscow, and it's packed out like there's going to be a huge football match there. And in fact, what they're there to see is a propaganda jamboree, if you like. And lots of young children come on the stage with lots of soldiers, and the children are Ukrainian children, very young. Some of them look to me 6-7 years old. And they're given microphones and they're told to thank the soldiers who saved them, the Russian soldiers. So these very young Ukrainian kids they end up running over to the Russian soldiers and hugging them and saying, thank you for saving our lives in Mariupol. And of course, the point is that did they really save their lives? What were they saving their lives from? The Russians would say we were saving them from an invasion, but as you've just analyzed, it was Russia's own invasion. And the other terrible thing about this, of course, is that these little children, what more do they know? If somebody says you were saved from Ukrainian bombs, they will believe that. They will believe what people tell them. They're cut off from their parents and their normal social networks, so they have nobody to counter that narrative. And you know, one of the interesting things here is that the younger the child is, the more vulnerable they are to these to Russian narratives, the more likely they are to believe them. But also, you know, the younger they are, if you think about it, one of the children we feature in our program was 3 years old when he vanished from Mariupol. He will be 5 years old now. He spent nearly half his life in Russian hands. There's a possibility, as his young auntie told us, there's a possibility he won't remember his family. He probably won't. I mean, he wouldn't have ever known his address, really, if he's asked where he's from. He'll have very vague memories, which, as the months and years go on, will begin to dim even more. So the younger they are, the more likely they are to end up being convinced by Russian propaganda and having no clue as to get home.
And the parents and the, you know, what they're going through, wondering where their child is, what condition they're in, how they're being treated. That's just agony.
Yeah, it really is. There's a young child in our program, the one I just alluded to then, who's called Max, who was 3 when he disappeared from Mariupol. You know, he was it's a fascinating story. His family were driving to escape from Mariupol in the early days of the war, and they were ambushed by soldiers. And there were six people in the car, and nearly everybody was killed, apart from this little three-year-old boy. And we know that he survived, right. And we know he ended up going to a hospital in Mariupol.
And where he is now, that's the mystery, the mystery of your documentary. Paul Kenyon, thank you so much for joining us. The program tonight airs on PBS, KLRN in San Antonio, 9 o'clock Central, Children of Ukraine. It is emotional. I highly recommend it. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
Hello, this is Coach Greg Popovich of the San Antonio Spurs. It's important to support public radio because I think it's really one of the very few sources I can think of that allows you to think for yourself. And that sounds like a simple act, but these days it's difficult to think for yourself because you're bombarded by so many people who have so many opinions. So to find a source of information that allows you to just listen, to integrate the information, to come to some conclusion about A, B, or C is really a gift. And because it's so rare, it's important to ensure that it stays around. And it's almost like part of being a good citizen. You know, to have such a source allows all of us to make good decisions. It helps our city, helps our country, and helps us raise our families in some ways, and to continue to pass on the information to them so that they can make their decisions. So I think it's important for those reasons. To become a member, visit tpr.org.
Okay, I really love that message from Coach Pop. That's such a good one.
Can't say no.
You can't say no to Coach Pop. I mean, I feel like he, speaking of Joyce, they had a really great friendship. And he's been a longtime supporter to TPR. And I was lucky enough for a long time to work at the Spurs for about 21 years while they had a heck of a run there. And there's a lot of the philosophy of leadership that Joyce instills here about, you know, every little thing that you do adding up to the bigger stuff, and doing it right and doing it well. And I think Coach Pop instills that a lot in the team as well. And you get to hear that in the quote about, you know, the Jacob Riis quote about pounding the rock and the stone cutter at his work every day, doing the little things that add up to eventually, you know, that stone breaks in half. And you know that it wasn't that one blow, but everything that had come before that does it. And I feel like that's the story of our fundraising drives, Dave. Like, it is every single little pledge. It's everybody pitching in across the community, whether you can give $10 or you can give $1,000. And that's kind of the extent and everything in between that adds up to our bigger goal. And I know we talked about this the last time we were on air, but we have a $15,000 goal to raise by 2 p.m. today. We're down to $3,798 to go to achieve that goal. And we have 80 new and upgraded sustaining members, which is 80 families that are going to receive the alarm, the free fire alarm for their homes to help them, alert them, you know, in the case that they may need it to get out of a home that's that is on fire, get them to safety.
So the number to call to do your part to help us be the stone cutters who keep Texas Public Radio strong, 800-622-8977, 800-622-8977. Your support is essential. Your support is not optional. You know, we need you. Everyone has to do their part in order to have the public radio station that we all can be proud of, that will do the work to represent you, not just here on the air in San Antonio, but across the country and frequently around the world. Our stuff is heard everywhere. And so if you can call right now, 800-622-8977, your pledge at $5 a month, that would be welcome. If that works for you, that would be great.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.